So, as I started last week, this year is the 1,700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. Christian churches all over the world, all different sorts of communions and denominations, are celebrating this time, recognizing it, and I didn't want us to be left behind. So I went to our pastors and said, hey, I'd like to do this thing. And they said, great, we have 4 weeks available. And I said, well, I'm not going to be available for the fourth, but I can give you 3 weeks of this, and I could just go on and on. And they said, yeah, that's great. So here we are. Last week we talked a little bit about Arius. We stressed the fact that the people who followed him are called Arians with an I, not Arians with a Y. Absolutely no connection whatsoever. Arius was a presbyter, that is to say a priest, above a deacon, below a bishop, in the church of Alexandria in Egypt. Alexandria was the sort of the intellectual center of Christianity in those days. He was concerned for the absolute unity of God. Strict monotheism. This, of course, comes from the Old Testament. It's a crucial feature of Judaism. It was a crucial feature of Christians. There is only one God. That obviously brings up the question, if there's only one God, and we're worshiping Jesus as God, is Jesus that same God? In fact, is he the Father? Is he if he's separate from the Father, how do you figure that out? Well, for hundreds of years, Christians have been worshiping Jesus as God, the Father's God, and recognizing the divinity of the Holy Spirit. They had been worshiping the Trinity. They hadn't worked it all out. Sometimes you do things before you've worked out the whole intellectual framework. Sometimes you just know what's right and you do what's right. They had been worshiping Jesus as God. But Arius was struggling with that. And as I said, he wanted to maintain the absolute oneness of the Father. And so he came up with an idea, largely influenced by Greek philosophy, and that's over here. You have God or the Father. Notice this line here. This is the big line. It is the great ditch, as Leslie would have said, between the uncreated and the created. On the uncreated side, there's just God. He's not even Father yet. We'll discover that. We'll see why in a minute. And then this God, the uncreated, a long time ago, created the Son. And then the Son created the world. Or perhaps the Son created a smaller God, and a smaller God, and again a smaller God in ascending order until he finally got to the God at the bottom of the chain who actually did the dirty work of making the world. Not clear to me what Arius thought. This is what the Greeks thought. But the key thing is the Son is created. And so the Arian slogan was, there was a time when he, the Son, was not. He came into existence. That means that this God up here wasn't always the Father. He wasn't the Father until he had a Son. So the Arians like to call him the unoriginated or the uncreated. That was their name for him. They didn't like the Father as much because he wasn't always the Father. So that was Arius's view. Now, his boss in the church at Alexandria was the bishop named Alexander. And you're thinking, he must have had the inside track to be bishop of Alexandria because he was already named for the city. Well, I don't know how that worked. Everybody was called Alexander in those days. So Alexander said, no, this is wrong. And boss and employee weren't getting along. There was strife. And that's where we left off last week. All right. So a lot of controversy is happening here. There were earnest Christians who were attracted by Arius's view because they too, and correctly, wanted to maintain strict monotheism. And so they were trying to think of how can we have one God and then the Son being sort of divine. And the Arian answer, which is that the Son is semi-divine. He's created, but he's a lower kind of God. He's a junior varsity God, as I like to say. That seemed to them to fix it. They found that the tools of Greek philosophy gave them a way to solve the problem. And so it wasn't like these people were raving heretic bad people. They were trying to resolve what they saw in the scriptures in their faith. So that was Arius. Had a lot of followers. Bill.
Are we talking 4th or 5th century here?
We're talking the very late 200s, early 300s.
Okay.
Very early 300s. So that was Arius. All right. So controversy. And this was a time when people cared about these things. No one was saying, doctrine divides. Can't we just love one another? They were into this. Some idea of how stirred up ordinary Christians were comes from this quote from Gregory of Nyssa. Nyssa was a place in what we now call Turkey. Gregory is one of the three Cappadocian fathers, if that name means anything to you. Well, in today's marketplace or workplace, you might meet a stranger and talk about whether we think the Seahawks will make the playoffs this year or whether it will rain tomorrow. That's what we talk about. Here's what they talked about in the ancient world. This is Gregory. If you ask anyone for change, like, you know, you buy something. If you ask anyone for change, he will discuss with you whether the Son is begotten or unbegotten. If you ask about the quality of bread, you will receive the answer that the Father is greater, the Son is less. If you suggest that you require a bath, you will be told there was nothing before the Son was created. They really cared about this. Their religion was at stake, and their religion was their life. So the local councils were called to deal with this and to try to convince Arius he was wrong. The church was used to having councils and so on. But they didn't really resolve the issue. Then Constantine comes onto the scene. This is a huge development when Constantine becomes a Christian. Now, you probably remember, I hope you remember, some of your Roman history, and you remember that the Roman Empire was becoming unwieldy, hard to govern, and so they split the empire in two, a western half and an eastern half. The western half had as its capital Rome, the old capital, and the eastern half had its capital in the area of what becomes Constantinople in Turkey. But if you have two emperors, what's going to happen? Well, one emperor wants to be the top emperor. So they have battles, and actually within each half you have battles. The number two guy in the west wants to be the number one guy. So they have lots of wars. And all this comes to a head. Actually, I need to come back to that in a moment. Hold that thought. It's all coming to a head. But this is the Roman world. Remember that in the Roman world, there were gods for everything. They were very polytheistic. The Romans brought in a god. Every time they conquered another country, they just brought the gods of that country and plopped them down in Rome and started worshiping them. In that sense, they were very tolerant. They were embraced the religion of the people they conquered, and they just sort of added to their gods. You remember in Acts chapter 17, Paul is on the Mars Hill in Athens, and he sees all these statues to gods, and then there's one to an unknown god, the idea being, if we've missed one, this will cover it. In Augustine's City of God, he's talking about Roman religion and how foolish it is. And he has a fascinating description of all the different gods for every different part of life. Every human activity has a god. In fact, every human activity is subdivided into subcategories. And there's a god for each one of those. And you got to worship all those gods to make everything go right. Then the Roman emperor started deciding that he was going to be a god too. This began in the East where they had a tradition of that. But they started saying, nope, you got to worship me. At first it was doing after their death. After Julius Caesar died, for instance, he was deified. You read Suetonius's Lives of the 12 Caesars, for instance. And the name is always so-and-so, afterwards deified. It's almost like it's part of his name. And then he started asking to be worshipped during their life. You had to give worship to the emperor. You had to burn incense. Well, Christians could not do this. Jews were actually an exception. The Jews were an extremely refractory people. The Romans hated them, but they couldn't quite stamp them out. I read somewhere that one quarter of the Roman military budget, at roughly the time of Christ, one quarter of the Roman military budget went to Judea. And if you think about the size of the Roman Empire and all the attacks from the barbarians along the northern border and similar things going on in North Africa, not as much there, and fighting the Parthians and all that sort of thing. And you think that one quarter of the budget went to this teeny little, the Romans would say, godforsaken part of the empire. It tells you how refractory, how stubborn the Jews were. They were going to worship on them. Well, the Romans gave them an exception. Judaism was an allowed religion, so they were exempt from worshiping the emperor. And when Christianity started, of course, it was a form of Judaism. All of its leaders were Jewish. They were saying this is simply what was predicted in the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew Bible. And so the Romans, to the extent they were even aware of Christians, said, well, they're just another denomination, another sect of Judaism. They get a pass. Well, then you know the Jews as a whole, obviously not every Jew, but in general, the Jews rejected Jesus and rejected Jesus and started persecuting them. Obviously, we know the first great persecutor is the Apostle Paul before he became the Apostle. Kicking the Christians out of the synagogues alerted the Romans to the fact that these guys aren't Jews. Oh, now they fall under the law that they have to give worship to the emperor. Well, the Christians largely did not do that. And so there was great persecution. You know that conventionally there are 10 waves of persecution. You probably can't narrow it down to just 10. And the persecutions sometimes were local. Sometimes they weren't bad. Sometimes they were bad. The worst of all the persecutions actually comes right at the end of this period, under Diocletian in the late 200s and early 300s. That was, the emperor was directly involved. Sometimes the persecutions were just like a local governor got zealous and started persecuting Christians without the emperor being too terribly aware of it. But Diocletian said, no, we're going to stamp this out. We're going to stamp it out everywhere. It was a terrible persecution. It's probably an example of it always gets worse just before it gets better. So, Christians are under severe persecution. And then something totally unpredicted happened. The Roman emperor, and it was actually just at first the Western emperor, becomes a Christian. He's in the midst of the civil war, which I left you at a few minutes ago. He's in the middle of the civil war. He's near Rome fighting Maximian. And you know the story. Before the battle, he sees a vision, the cross and the legend, by this sign conquer. He has all of his men sew crosses on their uniforms, and they win the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. It was 28 October, the year 312, and he became the sole emperor in the western half of the empire. The next year, in 313, he issued the Edict of Milan, which granted religious toleration to Christians and actually to all other religions. He was doing this primarily with Christians in mind. He favored Christianity. He ordered the church property confiscated and the persecutions to be restored. He gave money for the building of new churches and so on. By the way, Constantine did not make the empire Christian. He allowed toleration in 313. He clearly favored Christianity. He was a Christian himself. But Christianity did not become the official religion of the Roman Empire until 380, when the Emperor Theodosius issued the Edict of Thessalonica. So for Christians, the conversion of Constantine and the Edict of Toleration was a bit like waking up in heaven. They had to pinch themselves to make sure they weren't dreaming. For years, they had been a persecuted minority. Now, the most powerful man on the face of the earth was on their side. He was one of them. Well, many have doubted Constantine's conversion. As we've seen, Dan Brown, in his book, The Da Vinci Code, claims that he was always a pagan. Certainly, what we would call his Christian walk left much to be desired. He murdered his wife and oldest son. Not a good thing. We don't even ask in membership interviews in this church, have you murdered your wife or oldest son? We sort of figure that goes without saying. But he did. But of course, this is also a world in which there's always dynastic struggles. You have the sons fighting among the other to supplant dad and maybe supplant him a little quicker than nature would allow. He seemed to mix some of the prevailing pagan ideas, such as worship of the sun god Sol, with his Christianity. But most of us know Christians who have some screwy ideas that could use in correction of the scriptures. All of us know that we fall short of what God requires of us. All of us know the reality of Romans 7. The good that I would do, I do not do. So I think there is really no good reason to doubt the sincerity of Constantine's Christian faith. He was deeply interested in the health of the Christian church, and he was disturbed by the dissension swirling around Arius and his preaching of a created son. The church had been in the habit of calling councils or synods. Synod is just a Greek word that means council, to resolve issues of faith and practice. You all know in Acts chapter 15, the church was struggling with the question of what happens to Gentiles who become Christian? Do they have to become Jews first? In other words, in the case of men, do they have to be circumcised? Do they have to be Jews and take on the entirety of the Mosaic law, including the ceremonial, what we would call the ceremonial law? Others would say, no, you don't. You can become a Christian without going through the preliminary step to become a Jew. The church was in turmoil. They called a council. The elders and apostles got together, and as you recall, they said, no, you don't have to become a Jew first. They had many other councils, as I said, local councils. This was the first time there was a council that was intended to include the whole earth. The Greek word oikoumene. That's where we get the word ecumenical. So this was called the first ecumenical council, the first council covering the entire known world, which to a Roman meant the Roman Empire. They were vaguely aware there was something out there, but it didn't really count. So they called this, he called this council. Constantine summoned all the bishops of the whole church to meet near his capital in a city called Nicaea in what is now called Turkey. I mentioned that the empire had been divided into two. Constantine became the emperor, sole emperor of the western half when he won the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in 312. Later, he goes to war against the Eastern Empire guy, Licinius, I think his name was, and wins that. So now the empire is unified again. You got one guy at the top, and he moves his capital to the east, Nicaea. So you got your Turkey that looks kind of like this. So here's Judea, here's Syria, Egypt, the Nile. And a bit of Greece sticks down like this. And this is the Black Sea. Write that one. Right here is where Constantinople and later Istanbul is. Nicaea is kind of right over there. So we're talking about, and then the rest of Greece is here. Greece doesn't look like that. So he calls his council to Nicaea. It's close to his capital. He made the imperial post available to bring the bishops and their assistants from as far away as Cordova in Spain, and which is, you know, off the map there. The post is not like our post office. It's more like the Pony Express. It carries people as well as documents. You might think of the imperial post as like the state airline. So he made the imperial post available to all these fellas from all over. They estimate that about 2,000 people were at this council. Some, of course, just traveled from, you know, over here. But some traveled from the literally ends of the known world. Then he put them up, lodged them, and fed them. It was a tremendous undertaking, and it was a big sign of his care for the church. So there are some questions about the exact dates of the council. It began either late May or early June, 325, and concluded sometime in July. So that's the date you want to keep in mind. So you can tell it's 13 years after he became a Christian at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. There were probably about 250 bishops. We have each with his retinue from all over the Roman Empire, Spain on the west, Persia to the east. We have lists of all the bishops. The accuracy of the list is somewhat doubtful. They don't always agree, and there's different numbers. This is not surprising to me. 1,700 years later, when I go to a presbytery meeting, there's a sign-in sheet. There's a sign-in sheet Thursday night. Some guys sign in, some guys don't. People wander in Friday morning. Sometimes they sign in, sometimes they don't. There are guys who are notorious for leaving right after lunch on Friday. I won't name his name, but he always comes for, leaves right after lunch. Even though the rest of us are gone until, you know, who knows how late on Friday. Some guys wander in late. Sometimes when a vote is taken, guys are out in the hall talking about something, either great importance or fishing. Not to say that fishing isn't important if you're so inclined, but you know, you get the idea. Well, the point is, even in our world, the lists kind of vary. So the fact that they're not precisely the same doesn't really mean a whole lot. Athanasius later said that there were 318 bishops. He actually said at one point there was like about 300. In another book, he said 318. We sort of settled on 318, although the scholars say it was more like 250. And this council is often called the Council of the 318 Fathers. And now, if you're really up on your Bible, you'll say to yourself, 318. That's the number of men in Abraham's army, his household army, when he went to war with the kings who had captured Lot in Genesis 14, 14. They were really into numbers in those days. You read Augustine, for whom I have almost unbounded appreciation and admiration. And it's fascinating to me how he'll go on for a long time about some number. And this number is the sum of this squared and that squared, because those numbers are big, are really important numbers, and you square them and add them, and you get even more important numbers. And I think, you know, I love numbers. I'm an engineer. But I don't look at the numbers the same way Augustine does. I kind of think I'm right. But, you know, one of the values of reading old books and old people and reading from a lot of different periods is that it sort of challenges your thought. It sort of opens your idea, thought, mind to the idea that maybe I am not the center of the universe. Maybe I am not the accumulation of all the wisdom of the world. Maybe other peoples have had some ideas that I should look into. Well, enough of that. I mentioned Athanasius. Athanasius was there as a deacon. That is the first step on the ladder of clerical positions below a priest. He was there as a deacon assisting his bishop, Alexander. He didn't play a great role in the council. He becomes very important later, but he's mostly a bystander observing in this first time. We have no record that Arius himself was at the council. Position was argued forcefully by several bishops, most notably two men, both confusingly named Eusebius. And one of them in particular becomes really important later.
Eusebius and his other brother Eusebius.
Yeah, his other brother Eusebius. Two Eusebii. This one, Caesarea Nicomedes. I think it's more in Turkey. This is along the Syrian coast. He's particularly known to us because he wrote a lot. He's considered the first historian of the church. He wrote a book called The History of the Church, starting at with Adam, basically, and running up to I think just at the conversion of Constantine. He finished his book before the Council of Nicaea, so his history doesn't cover the council. He was a confidant of the emperor. He spent a lot of time with the emperor. He interviewed the emperor. He got a lot of details from the emperor. By this sign conquered is a detail. The vision comes from Constantine telling Eusebius what actually happened. Eusebius wrote a book called The Life of Constantine, where he talks about the council. I'm going to read a little bit from that in a minute. So, very important guy, less important guy. Both of these guys found the Arian point of view somewhat convincing. Both of them, particularly this one, later changed their mind and fell in line with Orthodoxy. All right, so I said Arius, we have no record that Arius was actually at the council himself. We have no minutes of this particular council. We have minutes for all of the ecumenical councils afterwards, which if you think about it, 1,600 years or 1,650 years, they have the minutes. They're all in Greek, but they have the minutes. We don't have the minutes of this. We do have several eyewitness accounts. The emperor invites the leaders of the church to come to his home, sort of, invites them all to this great hall. It's an incredible moment. As I said, if you were a bishop being brought, coming into that big chamber, expecting the emperor to come in, and thinking, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, could never have dreamed this would happen. So this is Eusebius of Caesarea describing the emperor's entrance in his life of Constantine. And first of all, three of his immediate family entered in succession, then others also preceded his approach, not of the soldiers or guards who usually accompanied him, but only friends in the faith. Emperors, kings, always come with a retinue. And they always come with force, with soldiers, both to protect them and to drive home the fact that this man comes with power. Constantine did come with his soldiers into the council. He came with his family and friends in the faith. And now, all rising at the signal, which indicated the emperor's entrance, at last he, the emperor himself, proceeded through the midst of the assembly, like some heavenly messenger of God, clothed in raiment which glittered, as it were, with rays of light, reflecting the glowing radiance of a purple robe, and adorned with the brilliant splendor of gold and precious stones. Such was the external appearance of his person. And with regard to his mind, it was evident that he was distinguished by piety and a godly fear. As soon as he had advanced to the upper end of the seats, at first he remained standing, and when a low chair of wrought gold had been set down, set for him, he waited until the bishops had beckoned to him and then sat down. And after him, the whole assembly did the same. Constantine was the emperor. No one could forget that. But he was a brother in the faith. And he was not a bishop, as he makes very clear. He makes clear that he has no standing as a bishop like these other men do. The presiding bishop, who was probably Hostius of Cordoba in Spain, way over there, gave an opening speech, and then Constantine responded with his own speech, ending with these words. Delay not, dear friends, delay not, ye ministers of God and faithful servants of him who is our common Lord and Savior. Begin from this moment to discard the causes of that disunion which has existed among you, and remove the perplexities of controversy by embracing the principles of peace. For by such conduct, you will at the same time be acting in a manner most pleasing to the Supreme God, and you will confer an exceeding favor on me, who am your fellow servant. That's how Constantine viewed himself. He wanted the church to come to one mind. There was controversy. Remember, Dan Brown says that before the council, no one had even dreamed of Jesus being divine. He was purely human. And Constantine hammered down the truth, and said, nope, he's got to be divine. Well, that's silly. There was controversy because they knew he was divine, but they weren't quite sure how divine he was. Constantine did not lay down an answer. He laid down sort of the characteristics of the answer, which is a characteristic mean everybody agreed. That's what he wanted. All right, so the council discussed a number of issues, as I said. The Arian controversy, of course, is what gets our full attention. The Meletian schism was something I'll talk about very briefly in a minute. I'll talk about it later. The date of Easter, mentioned that before, and a whole bunch of miscellaneous issues. Let's talk about the creed. Well, as I said, we don't have the minutes. We do have several eyewitness accounts. So we don't know the exact sequence of what went on. It seems that originally a formula was proposed that used only scriptural language, a formula to express the council's conviction about the deity of the Son of God. They only used scriptural language. But the Arian party, this is Athanasius told us this, the Arian party signaled to each other with winks and nods that they could agree with these words while meaning something different. This is a really important thing. It's a theme throughout church history. People say, yeah, I agree with this, but internally they're saying, but to me, the words mean something different. So I can pretend to agree with you. I can convince you that I'm agreeing with you, but I really don't, and I'm still holding to my own opinions. This made the anti-Arians realize that they needed some new language. The key word that will come up, and we'll talk about this later, is a word that means something like of the same substance. It's the famous homoousios that you may have heard of. So they're saying we need to come up with some more words that guard the truth, that essentially separate the Arians from what I'll call the Orthodox. We need some words that make it really clear that we believe the Son is uncreated. A lot of people said, well, no, we just used Bible words. As soon as we use other words, we're getting in trouble. You know, particularly use words that the philosophers use, because philosophy is all bad, they say. Well, I don't think it is. But it always has to be in submission to the scriptures. They recognized they needed another creed. Well, then, one of the Arians, this guy, Nicomedia, read out a creed. This one used scriptural language, but it was obviously Arian in its intent. It obviously taught the Son was not fully divine. This led to an uproar. This may be where the story of St. Nicholas punching out a supporter of Arius arose. You know that story?
No.
You always... Really?
No.
Oh, okay. Jonathan talks about it all the time. He sends out, he tweets memes of St. Nick punching a guy out. Don't you listen to your own son? I know you don't listen to me anymore, but anyhow, you know the story. You've heard the story, and everybody gets a lot of...
No.
Apparently not. Okay. around Christmas time, people like to talk about St. Nicholas. He punched out in Arius. Yeah, that's jolly St. Nick. Well, it turns out there was actually a bishop named Nicholas. He was from a town in Myra, which is, I don't know, someplace there in Turkey. And he was a strong supporter of Alexander, strong supporter of what we later called Nicene Orthodoxy. I don't know if he actually punched it. There is a story that he slapped somebody. We don't really know. That story comes from several centuries later. But if it didn't actually happen, it at least gives you a sense of the flavor. People were worked up. I don't know if they actually came to blows, but they were really worked up. And they were worked up at this idea that Nicomedia was saying, let's just come out in the open and say the Son is not fully divine. Well, the fact that the Arian party could propose a creed using scriptural language that obviously taught what they thought was unscriptural, namely that the Son was created, convinced the bishops that they needed a creed with some extra biblical language, language that wasn't in the Bible. This is a theme throughout church history. You've heard people say, no creed but Christ. And they're reacting to, you know, this denomination's statement of beliefs and that denomination's in. If we just have Christ, it'll solve everything. But if you know anything about people who say no creed but Christ, they very much have a creed. They very much have a set of doctrines. Usually theirs is that their church is the only true church. They certainly have beliefs. It comes to baptism, for instance. They believe their view on baptism is right and yours is wrong. They have a creed. They just don't write it down and sort of, they're not up front with it. You perhaps also know the saying, every heretic has his text. Pop quiz. Anybody know who said that?
Say it again. Every what?
Every heretic has his text.
P.G. Woodhouse.
Not P.G. Woodhouse. And not Rayburn. Yeah, Robert Rayburn is usually a good guess.
Machen?
Not Machen, no.
Joseph Smith.
Johann von Eck. And he said this in opposition to Martin Luther. So, in that sense, if we're going to divide the world into good guys and bad guys, which I like to do sometimes, he was a bad guy. And he was attacking Luther, saying, every heretic has his text. Sure, Martin, you come to me with all these Bible verses, but you're wrong. Well, the thing is, Eck was correct. I mean, he was wrong in disagreeing with Luther, I think. I'm a Protestant, not a Roman Catholic. But he identified a key point. Every heretic, everybody who departs from the faith, can find some text to latch onto and then write it farther than it should be written. You know, Jehovah's Witness, Mormons, any particular version of Christianity you want to think of can come up with a text. Let's say you believe in paedobaptism, infant baptism, as I do. Talk to a Baptist brother. The Baptist brother has texts. They don't convince me because I don't think they say what he thinks they do, and my texts don't convince him. Every heretic has a text. It's not enough just to come up with a Bible verse. Sometimes you have to do a lot more than that. And then, lest you think I'm really straying too far away from the Bible, let's go to the Bible. Here is Peter. And count the patience of our Lord as salvation, just as our beloved brother Paul also wrote to you according to the wisdom given him, as he does in all his letters when he speaks of them, of these matters. There are some things in them that are hard to understand, here's the payoff, which the ignorant and unstable twist to their own destruction as they do the other scriptures. You therefore, beloved, knowing this beforehand, take care that you are not carried away with the error of lawless people and lose your own stability. Well, at least two things to be drawn from that passage. I often point to that as a proof that even as the New Testament was being written, Peter, at least, recognized that Paul's letters were part of the Bible. They were part of the Scriptures. The New Testament wasn't even complete, but Peter knew the New Testament was being written and that the letters that came from Paul were part of what we later come to call the canon of the Bible, the canon of the New Testament. That's the first thing that I always draw attention to. But the other thing, and that's what I want to talk about today, you can twist the Scriptures. You can just quote the Bible and come up with a doctrine that takes you straight to hell. You can twist the Scriptures. So anyhow, the Orthodox fathers there said, we need a better creed. We need a creed that will really differentiate between the Arians, one that will guard the true divinity, the full divinity of the Son of God. And so the creed that we call the Nicene Creed was proposed. They used the Greek word homoousios, which I'll mention, I think, a little bit later. Yeah, I'll write it right now. Homoousia. This part means saying, homogenized milk is milk where it's all sort of mixed up together, so it's all the same all through. And ousia is a word that means being. We'll talk a little bit more next week about what they really meant, what being means, what substance means, and so on. But that was the key word that wasn't in the Bible that they came up with that would make a sharp dividing line between the people who didn't believe the Son was divine and those who believed he was. As I said, next week we'll actually look at the creed, the language of the creed itself. Now we're here to do more of the historical stuff. Some other issues that they resolved. I'm sorry, got ahead of myself. So they came up with this new creed, the Nicene Creed. You remember in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, the fellow who is the mouthpiece for Dan Brown says that Jesus was only considered human up until the council, and that it was sort of imposed, the divinity of Jesus was imposed at that point, and that it was a very close vote. Of the 250 to 320, we don't know exactly how many, of the 200 plus bishops who were present, all but two signed the Nicene Creed. Two. So that's a vote of like 240 or 328 to 2. Not a very close vote, as Dan Brown would say. It was overwhelming. Two did not sign. We have their names. I forget what they are off the top of my head. They were exiled. And as I mentioned, that's the beginning of a bad trend where the government started to interfere in the affairs of the church. It's one thing to say you're unorthodox and we're putting you out of the church. It's another thing to say you've got to leave the empire. You've got to go off into the wilds of Germany or someplace. Anyway, overwhelming approval of the creed. All right, so other issues. There's the Meletian Schism. This arose from a question of what to do with Christians who had lapsed under Roman persecution. That is, they had either they offered incense to the emperor. In some cases, they had simply given over sacred books. In some cases, those sacred books weren't the Bible. Sometimes they were like hymnals, or equivalent of hymnals. The Roman authorities often didn't know any better. They didn't say, hey, you just gave me a hymnal, not your actual Old Testament. They didn't know any better. But sometimes that would satisfy the rules. Well, that was considered a fall. And those people were put out of the church. Then when the persecution subsides, these people repent. They come back to the church. And they say, I was weak. I didn't want to get killed. And so I did this thing. But I want to be part of the church. The church had a problem. What to do with these people? This problem arose many, many a time. It got particularly acute when one of the lapsed was a clergyman. Maybe a bishop. So now a new bishop comes to take his place. He starts ordaining people. People start being baptized by this guy. The old guy comes back. And they had a rule that you only had one bishop in a locality, in a town. It wasn't like, We have a church on every corner, and we split our churches all the time. They didn't allow that. That was a big deal. And they had to deal. What do we do with this? Some of you will remember that St. Augustine, a little bit later in this century and beginning of the next century, had a struggle with what's called the Donatist controversy in North Africa. This is the same thing. The church struggled over and over what to do with people who have fallen. And of course, it's a larger, it's a part of the larger question. What do you do with people who sin? What sort of repentance do you expect? What sort of sins really put you outside of the church? That was a big deal. They resolved it. I won't tell you how. You'll want to look it up. Read it for yourself. But it was a big deal. The date of Easter, I mentioned this before. You had different parts of the church, people celebrating Easter on different days. And that meant they were doing Lent on different days. And so you had the spectacle of, in one part of the empire, people were fasting because they were in Lent. And then a little bit further down the road, you had people feasting because Easter had come. And this was considered very unseemly. Again, they had an idea of the unity of the church. The church had one faith and one practice, or should have. And it bothered people that they were doing different things. So anyhow, they worked out a way of calculating the date of Easter. And then there were the canons. So the Greek word canon, which is not... that word, that's artillery. This word canon means a rule. It was used for like a plumb line. You know how builders use a plumb line to determine what's vertical. It's a rule. You've heard the term canon law. These are rules that govern the church. So they came up with a bunch of canons. Canon also is used, still in the sense of rule, but now to indicate books that belong in a set. So sometimes when we just say the canon, what we mean is the list of books that belong in the Bible, or the canon of the Old Testament, the canon of the New Testament. Canon is used generally in literature. So people talk about the canon of Shakespeare. Those are the plays that we are sure were written by Shakespeare. And you know, there's others that we're not sure of. Less intellectually, there is the canon of Star Trek. The movies that belong that were done by Star Trek. There is the canon of James Bond movies. And of course, there is the question is, does the original Casino Royale really belong in the canon? Because it wasn't done by Cubby Broccoli or whatever. I don't know. I'm not totally into that. Well, the canon. The canon and as far as church law, I'm not going to talk about that anymore. But we're moving on now to talk about the canon of Scripture. One thing the council did not do was decide the canon of Scripture. There's no record in any of our sources that the council discussed the canon at all. Why not? It wasn't an issue. Why am I making a big deal of this? Because Dan Brown claims that the canon was imposed by Constantine at the Council of Constantinople. Brown said that there were 80 gospels floating around. And Constantine picked out 4 that emphasized the deity of Christ, and he burned all the ones that talked about the humanity of Christ. Well, that's poppycock. Even historians who oppose Orthodox Christianity, and I mean Bart Ehrman here, say there were never anywhere near 80 Gospels. The 4 Gospels we have were always accepted, and only those 4, right from the beginning. The Gospels we have are shot through with the humanity of Jesus. The disciples never even dreamed he wasn't human. They had a hard time grasping that he was divine. They thought he was a great prophet, but they obviously didn't really see him as the uncreated Son of God until later. It's absurd. You cannot read the Gospels for more than 5 minutes and think that somehow those four that got picked are the ones that emphasize divinity. On top of that, if you read some of these apocryphal Gospels, some of these other Gospels, they don't make him human at all. They actually make him almost a Buddhist. They make him a weird, super spiritual guy who doesn't eat. In fact, interesting thing about these Gospels, if you read them, there's almost no narrative. They're just sayings. So that's the four Gospels. There was not complete agreement on the contents of the New Testament at the time of Nicaea in 325. It's true. But most of the canon was set. There were just a few differences of opinion. Let's talk about the Gospels. Just one sounding point. Irenaeus, who wrote he died around 202 AD. So he's right in the last part of the 100s. He writes this: "It is not possible that the Gospels can be either more or fewer than they are. For since there are four zones of the world in which we live and four principal winds, while the church is scattered throughout all the world, and the pillar of the church is the gospel and the spirit of life, it is fitting that she should have four pillars, breathing out on every side and vivifying men afresh." Okay, you may not be terribly convinced by his reasoning, because there's four points to the compass, there have to be four gospels. But what's absolutely clear is that there are four Gospels. No one questions that.
What was his name?
Irenaeus. Irenaeus of Lyon, Bishop of Lyon. Irenaeus was a Greek, as you can tell from the name. Lyon, is in the south of France. It's on the Riviera. My personal opinion, I have no church history text to back this up, but my opinion is Irenaeus looked out the window one day, saw the snow coming, said, "It's off to the Riviera for me." So he went off to the south of France, became a bishop, wrote a famous book called Against All Heresies, great book. Basically said, I'm going to defend Christianity against every heresy there is out there. And boy, there were a lot of them. All right, that was Irenaeus, and again, he's just one. I could have picked a dozen or so, maybe four that I can think of off the top of my head. All of them saying, long before Nicaea, there are four Gospels. So Eusebius' church history, I mentioned Eusebius, which was completed just before the Council of Nicaea, lists the books of the New Testament in three categories. The generally accepted, there's the four Gospels, Acts, the Pauline epistles, which he included Hebrews, 1 Peter, 1 John, and maybe Revelation. Then there was the questionable or doubtful, James, Jude, 2 Peter, 2nd, 3rd John. So people weren't sure about James because it seemed so works-oriented. Remember, that was Luther's problem with it many years later. Jude was questionable to some because he quoted the book of Enoch. And they thought, wow, that's kind of sketchy. I'm not sure about that. 2 Peter, because the Greek style was considered too different from the Greek style of 1 Peter. 2nd, 3rd John, partly because the author is never named, and authorship was really important in deciding the canon. And it was also short. Of course, the fact that it was so short also meant it wasn't quoted very often. And part of the church's thinking here is the books get quoted a lot are probably good ones. So they weren't totally sure about these questionable ones. Later, about two-thirds of the way through the century, they settled for sure. Then there was the totally rejected ones. And these are all weird ones. Acts of Paul, the Shepherd of Hermas, the Apocalypse of Peter, the Epistle of Barnabas, Teaching of the Apostles, Gospel according to Hebrews. These are usually Gnostic books. Many of them are written to fill in gaps. And then there's the worse than rejected, the really rejected. That's funny because Eusebius says, well, there's three categories. And then he lists four. And somehow these are even worse than the rejected ones. I think of the famous Austrian physicist Wolfgang Pauli, who said about some paper that a young physicist gave him. He says, that's not right. That's not even wrong. Well, these were not even wrong. These were like the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Matthias, the Acts of Andrew, the Acts of John, and so on and so forth. You hear those names, and some of you may be thinking to yourself, National Geographic. A few years ago, National Geographic got really excited, and they said, wow, we've got this new gospel. It's a great gospel. It tells us all sorts of stuff about Jesus we never knew before, and particularly about Mary Magdalene, that is, and their kid, and boy, this is telling us Christianity like we've never had before. Well, it's a bunch of words that I don't use in church very often. It's a silly thing. It wasn't new. We've known about this for a long time. And all you have to do is read one of these apocryphal books, and you think, boy, this is not the same religion. This has nothing to do with Christianity. The Gospel of Thomas is particularly famous. They love the Gospel of Thomas except for the last verse. They're just going gangbusters on the Gospel of Thomas. There's a bunch of sayings, just sort of gnomic sayings, and they, wow, we love this guy. He's super spiritual. It's Gnostic wisdom from above. It's super secret wisdom. I have it. You don't. Isn't it great? And this is so much better than real Christianity. And then you get to the last verse where Jesus says, I think it says to Mary, if you become a man, you can enter the kingdom of heaven. Talk about popping the bubble. The super great feminist gospel up to the very last line. And they don't like to quote the last line, but it's there. And I can show it to you if you ask someday. All right. Between these two, we have the whole New Testament. These were questionable. No book that belongs in the canon was rejected at all. But they were a little uncertain about this. It took a little while for the church to come to one mind to this. It didn't happen at Nicaea. And it wasn't the Emperor Constantine who forced it. All right. Man, I never finished on time before in my life. But I have. So next week, we will discuss the actual text of the Creed. We'll look at just a few of the key things and then talk about its significance for today. Thanks for coming.